Okay, good morning. Welcome back. Today is Wednesday, October 19, 2022, class 11 in the series Apollonius of Tyana and the Sage. Completing, I hope, or getting close, this will be a shorter class, completing hopefully the very brief review of some of the key, what I think are the key points in Michael Lockwood's book, Unknown Buddha of Christianity, Crypto-Buddhism of the Essenes. The basic idea that Christianity has, I mean, he gives it the synopsis, a very tight understanding of where he's coming from. Page 50, he explains, and this is sort of brief to review last time. One, his basic themes. Christianity has been greatly influenced by Buddhism. Two, Jesus of Nazareth was not a historical person. Three, the good news, or euangelion, or euangelos, like evangelical, the root is Greek, the root of the word evangelical, the good news, or a person giving good news, is a Greek euangelion, which is really brought by the messenger. By an angel messaging, that the good news of the New Testament is really the good news of Buddhism. And he got into this whole long, I got into this whole long, detailed, involved explication how the original term for discourse in Pali Buddhism is sutta, which probably came out of the Sanskrit sutra. But after the several centuries memorized discourses of the Buddha were written down on paper on palm leaves, 100 BC or something, then brought to Alexandria by Buddhist scholars, in his view, brought from the Pali, which came out of the Sanskrit, back to Sanskrit, but influenced by Prakrit. Sutta, translated into Sanskrit as sutra, somehow was incorporated in the Christian teaching that they're bringing good news. And he said the Sanskrit terms suktam, good news, and there are many translations actually. It's really suktam, actually comes from something like well presented. And then this sutram, authoritative discourse, it actually also means thread. Sutra and sutta, the basic meaning is thread. And the root, the etymological root is sieve. Sieve means to weave or to thread. And so he's saying suktam, which means good news or happiness like sukha, and sutram, which means discourse, which came from thread, or both comes from suttam in Sanskrit's related vernacular Prakrit. Okay. And then he's saying the Sanskritists who were writing down Pali later, the Pali becoming Sanskrit a few hundred years later, had the problem of translating or dealing with the earlier centuries-long use of the Prakrit term suttam. And he seems to be equating Prakrit and Pali, that the suttam embodied both suktam and sutram. They only chose to use Sanskrit sutram, meaning sutra, as a common translation for sutta. And though the meaning of suktam dropped out of sight in Buddhist Sanskrit scriptures. So that's right, because there's no discussion of sutras or suttas as good news, or sukha in any way at all. Meaning, in Buddhism, there's no notion of the sutras or sutras or suttas in Pali are good news, but that's Christian. So he does a lot of stretching, and it's all disputable because actually, looking into, I have some pages for the specialists on the etymology of sutta and shukta and sutra. They all come, they come from multiple sources. So those English words, you have to look at the Sanskrit and the Pali, and then you have to look at the roots of the Sanskrit and the Pali, and then you have to look at the historical philology, philological history, meaning how did root compounds change and get recombined with other root compounds to make these words. And it's very complicated. And like he says, there's really no Christians who are interested in looking into Pali and Sanskrit etymology. So, but he's saying, his view is that by this sort of decision of Sanskritists to go with the meaning of, to translate suttaf to sutra, they lost the sukham, or the portion of meaning that was associated with good news or well spoken. All right. So, from page 50, if you're still involved, if you're still here, it's an intellectual exercise and seriously involved, and I am sure Sanskrit scholars will dispute him, and others will agree. He said, regarding stage one, Christianity truly, indeed being strongly influenced by Buddhism, if you were to ask most Christians, laypersons or ordained, whether Christianity has been influenced by Buddhism, you'd most likely be answered by looks of incomprehension. Indeed. This situation perhaps is to be expected when many churches keep their congregations engaged at a Sunday school level. Yes, dumbing down is going on everywhere, and it has been in, it's in Buddhism too, actually. Oh, look at that. A bird has alighted outside my window. Okay. Going on. In the 19th century, there actually were a number of scholars who were arguing for and against Buddhist influence on Christianity. And that's the very interesting point. The following select bibliography from Charles Francis Aiken's 1900 publication, 120 years ago. Two birds now. See? They like this. They like my sutta. Aiken's 1900 publication reveals that the question of Buddhism's influence on Christianity was indeed a subject vigorously discussed by academic theologians and historians of religion during the 19th century. And that's very true, actually. And I'm not going to go through the bibliography, but just... There are three birds now. Okie dokie. They're about 10 feet away from me outside the window on the vines. I think they're looking for the seeds, you know, for grass. Oh. Uh-huh. Maybe they're going to make a house. Oh, I think they're scoping the real estate for where to make the nest. So, anyway, the point is that we've lost humanity. We have been dehistoricized, or civilization is being progressively dehistoricized, meaning understanding of history and the past being blanked out with the under the principle that he who controls the past controls the future. Yeah, right. So 100 years ago, 200 years ago, 1820 or 1822, 200 years ago, and a little before, and for the last 100 years after that, 19th century mainly, there was a lot of discussion of the influence of Buddhism on Christianity. The level of scholarship was probably higher than today, and certainly the level of critical open-mindedness or open-minded critical exploration was greater than now academically, it seems, much less political. So there was a lot, and he goes on. I must note, however, that Aiken missed from his discussion and from his bibliography the name of the one of the most important supporters of Buddhist influence on Christianity, the German philosopher Schopenhauer, from around 1818 AD, 200 years ago. Schopenhauer understood that there's a genetic relationship between the older religion, Buddhism, and the younger, Christianity. He characterized, in an English translation of his German, as the grafting of Buddhist doctrine upon the mythological dogma of Judaism. And so there were a lot of scholars and heavy hitters like Schopenhauer and Schweitzer who quickly recognized in their intellectual honesty the significant parallelism and doctrinal compatibility resonance between Christian and Buddhist teaching. And his view was that their Buddhist doctrine was grafted onto a mythological dogma of Judaism, meaning a dogmatized, mythologized version of some of Judaism that became the Gospels. This, of course, is nowhere discussed publicly, or who would know? I don't read theological journals, Christian, but I would think that this is part of the decline of faith in the modern time. The decline of faith in the modern time. How the heck did that happen? Well, some part of it was probably this very serious questioning of the originality of Christianity, or the philosophical borrowings evident in the Gospels, borrowed from Buddhism, Hinduism, and borrowed and mythologized and modified from Judaism. Okay, he goes on. Why am I devoting 8 pages, which I'm not going to go through, of Aiken's select bibliography? Because in this 21st century, and this book came out in 2019, I think, there are organizers of international biblical conferences who would like to bar any discussion of Buddhist sources of the New Testament Gospels. Right? Hate speech, fake speech has to be barred from the conferences. So it's the liberal fascism. Liberal fascism is all over the place. So and he's sort of chafing under the fact that he's got a lot to say, and it's very interesting, and he's been barred from conferences, let alone academe. And so that's the way it goes, right? Like I talk about Buddhism, Taoism, Advaita Vedanta, and the raw material, there's nobody in any of those groups that would like to hear this, actually. None. Nearly none. At least those that are teaching. Because they don't know. And he goes to this point that in the second paragraph, he said, according to them, Buddhism provides no relevant sources for Christianity. And he said, I hope that this bibliography might show that such scholars are leading a blinded existence, and that there's been a century-long history, there's actually multiple centuries, of scholars debating the question of Buddhist influence on Christianity. So he who controls the past controls the future, and liberal, fascist, tyranny, authoritarianism, with a smile, does censorship to protect you. He goes on. We thus have the disgraceful situation of academics, many of whom are guiding doctoral candidates, refusing to entertain radical views that might well upturn their own theories. Of course, they don't want to bite the hand that feeds them, meaning the organizations that pay their salaries, and therefore lose their positions by bringing in views that might uproot or pull the rug out from under themselves. The great difficulty they face, of course, is that they would have to learn Sanskrit, Pali, and other Asian languages to engage intelligently in this debate, and they cannot. And that's actually one reason that a composite that I'm kind of giving here, right? Transpersonal psychology and the raw material and Pali Buddhism and Advaita Vedanta and Taoism and Confucianism and some Gnosticism, early Christianity, is not welcome anywhere. Because those that would be on the other side of the discussion don't know those fields. They don't want to talk about, they don't want to bring somebody who knows too much more, brings in too much more than they themselves can speak to. So he said, we expect doctoral candidates to equip themselves with the languages necessary for the research. Are distinguished professors going to refuse to do what they would demand of their own doctoral candidates? Of course, some are that way. And so, yeah, there's intellectual dishonesty. The academy specializes in intellectual dishonesty. Of course. Just like the churches and many organized religions and sects specialize in intellectual exclusion or dogmatic rejectionism, where they just dogmatic exclusion. They exclude that which doesn't accord to their dogma, particularly, especially if it might uproot the claims of originality or historicity of their dogma. If the authenticity, the originality, the arising out of, you know, a vacuum or coming inspired from God with no predecessor basis for which, for their theories, for their dogma, is questioned, or the more successfully it may be challenged, the more that messenger must be excluded. The messenger is damned with the message because it undercuts their livelihood. Happens everywhere, all over the place. You know, 3D repeaters don't do honesty very well, especially when they have power. When they have power and position, they are not really committed to truth and honesty. The paucity of honesty, as Ross said, absolutely. So, Aiken was 1863-1925. He was a summa cum laude graduate of Harvard's class of 1884, priest of the Catholic Church, and his doctorate was called the Dhamma of the Buddha and the Gospel of the Christ, a critical inquiry into alleged relations of Buddhism with primitive Christianity, early Christianity. And so this was written 120 years ago. It was his dissertation. And he's arguing against the claims of strong Buddhist influence in Christianity. And he said, he wrote his book to, quote, meet a want keenly felt in the field of Christian apologetics. And he's critical now and says, the specious attempts, false attempts, dishonest attempts to lay the Gospels under obligation to Buddhist teaching have shaken the faith of not a few Christians. The need of a thorough refutation is imperative. So his dissertation was a thorough refutation of the view that the Gospels are, quote, under obligation to Buddhist teaching. How about the idea that they simply borrowed, or truths, universal truths, are well enunciated by various traditions? You know, that it's not simply claims to originality and historical accuracy, historicity, right? Objective historical fact. Claims that the story of Jesus is objective historical fact. The doctrinal teachings are original. They're are authentic. They're not plagiaristic or borrowing or were not preceded by anybody anywhere. Something like that. They're directly from the Word of God, period, full stop, and thus unquestionably historical, not composited over centuries by multiple writers, not borrowed or taken from or related to any previous teachings. The stories are historically accurate, just as written. Those claims, all those claims are defending those positions of authenticity, originality, historicity, novelty, independence of other sources or other traditions, seems to them to be better than saying universal truths are shared by multiple traditions. None of them want to say, of course we have some of the same teachings as you do, because truth is one. And it's found in countless sources all over the place. You can find various universal truths. There's universal truth, there's personal truth, and then there's distortion, or mistake, or confusion. Or there are levels of truth, or there are different formulations of the same truths, and then there are different understandings based on evolution of truths. Like God is love. God is only love? No. God is one. You mean God is not dualism? No, God is all. Ah, so God is love, but not only love. God is one, but not only one. God is all. What is all? All is infinite. Ah, God is infinite. Okay, I can dig it. Those seem to be different levels of comprehension of the truth of the nature of source. And you can say one infinite creator, you can say Godhead, you can say absolute, you can say Satchitananda, or that's the bliss of it. You can say Paraparaman, you can say Paramatman, you can say Brahma, you can say Allah, you can say Jehovah, I guess. You can say all sorts of things. You can say Nibban. You can say intelligent infinity. No? They'll say no. They'll say no. Our formulation is the one and only best and accurate. They want that. These are 3D repeaters, okay? They, you know, competition and struggle is the line of least resistance. They'd rather fight and die to wage holy war because they think themselves holy and others profane than realize, look how much we share because we're all of the same source and we're all on the same path, thinking of it differently, progressing at our own pace with different understanding. They don't want to get together. They don't want that, actually. They'd rather say, ours is the only. And so, gospel's under obligation to Buddhist teaching. There's no obligation. How about truths are universal? Certain truths are universal, like soul or God or karmic law or causality. Soul evolution and cosmic plan is one. And all the different traditions have grasped certain elements of it. They don't like that, no. So he's just the way he formulates it. But then others would formulate it that way and say, too, oh, there's nothing original to the Gospels. It's all Buddhist teaching. Therefore, they're under obligation. So it's really the, Ross said, the law of confusion working overtime. In any case, Aiken gives this long bibliography. Authors comparing Buddhism with Christianity and treating of their alleged relationship, while he's basically saying, he's trying to refute them all. And this is, he said, a record of 19th century publications for and against that, quote, alleged relationship. And I'm not going to read them all at all. Not at all. Not all at all. But the first is 1825 from France, Paris, Le Moussat. And you've got them all over the place. German, French, English, there may be an Italian in there too, mainly German, French, and English, all the way to 1900. And so it's been long discussed that yes, indeed, there is much resonant and in common between gospel teaching and Buddhism, early, original Pali Buddhist teaching, for sure. Now, what he calls stage two, if you don't mind me whipping through all this here, stage two, this is in the PDF, page 61, his statement that the view that Jesus of Nazareth is an allegorical, non-historical character, right? This is the position of the non-historicity of the Gospel's life of Jesus, or Jesus as a person. Saying nothing about Apollonius here, interestingly, he starts and says, nearly half a century earlier than Schopenhauer's discovery around 1818, meaning in the 18th century, in 1750 or something, in 1750, 50 years or so earlier than Schopenhauer, figuring out in German that Buddhism had a great influence on Christianity, that's where it started, right? So all this 19th century scholarship that he traces from 1825 came after Schopenhauer's breakthrough discovery or work in showing the parallels or resonance between Christian and Buddhist teaching. But 50 years before that, 1750 or so, he said, we have evidence of young persons questioning the very historicity of Jesus of Nazareth. And he goes, however, the great difficulties that these young skeptics had to face may be grasped by the very negative reaction, obviously, to their skepticism by even so famous a skeptic critic of the Catholic Church as Voltaire. So you have hardcore skeptics and you have moderate skeptics. You have Voltaire as a skeptic critic of the Catholic Church, and then you have young skeptics who are more radical and had the view that there was no historical Jesus. And Voltaire, who's a moderate skeptic, is critical of the hardcore skeptics. Okay, so you've got levels of skepticism and levels of concession, of overlap, or resonance or similar or identical teaching? So some people say, yes, of course, they have some of the same teaching. And some people say, no, not at all. And so you've got hardliners and integrationists. Okay. He goes on, a quote from Voltaire, translated. This is from God and Human Beings, 1769. Okay, so Voltaire before Schopenhauer, and long before Schweitzer. Voltaire said, or wrote, quote, I saw some disciples of Bolingbroke, more ingenious than educated, who denied the existence of Jesus, because the story of the three wise men and the star and the massacre of innocents are, they said, the height of eccentricity, meaning they thought this is a silliness and fanciful. It's fanciful. The contradiction of the two genealogies that Matthew and Luke gave is especially a reason that these young men allege to persuade themselves that there was no Jesus, but they drew a very false conclusion. So that's Voltaire against the radical skeptics who say there's no historicity to Jesus. Of course, those people, they're just, you know, they're not scholars. They're just, they were just young fellows pointing out what didn't make sense or, you know, inconsistencies. The story of the three wise men and the star, it sounds quite mythological. And that's the idea of mythologized dogmatic Judaism. The borrowings from earlier Old Testament traditions. That's very reasonable. So, and he goes on and says, in the following 19th century, so we're talking about Voltaire in the 18th, leading to Schopenhauer in the 19th, at the beginning, leading to 100 years plus of European and UK scholarship on the parallels and relation between Buddhism and Christianity in the 19th century after Schopenhauer, when an increasing number of the aspects of the gospel stories were considered not to be historical, David Friedrich Strauss's Das Leben Jesu, kritisch bearbeitet. It's been a long time since I was in a German body, was first published 1835. So you've got Voltaire in 1769, writing God and Human Beings, criticizing the critics who doubted the historicity of Jesus. You've got Schopenhauer strongly bringing in strong evidence of Buddhist and Christian parallel teaching, or similar or comparable teaching. You've got this other fellow, Mr. Strauss, in 1835, writing this book, Das Leben Jesu, and he is creating quite a reaction among theologians. So the war had started. And this is not, you know, what about Apollonius, right? You had scholars looking at Apollonius in the 19th century too, presumably, right? And then you have scholars or critics or academics bringing in Buddhism. So there was a double-barreled attack on the historicity of the Jesus story and historical reality of Jesus as a first century being, and the originality, authenticity of the gospel teachings from the angle of those bringing in Buddhism and those who were saying Jesus is really Apollonius. And so this was a big hubbub. In 1860, there's a translation of the German, and he goes on, by the beginning of the 20th century, the reaction to such theories asserting the mythical nature of Jesus had certainly not diminished. A German scholar in 1909, and a couple of books, he said, with seeming relish, he faced in Berlin a scene of hysterical reaction at his 1910 public lecture, and this is around the same time as Steiner. So this was a real busy time intellectually. So there was a lot of intellectual ferment from the middle of the 18th century until the hippie era, and then progressively dumbing down was accelerated, or progressive dumbing down began and began to be accelerated. Diet, injections, and injunctions, as they say. By diet and injections and injunctions, making the man of the future who will be malleable, who will own nothing and be happy, who will say, most of them will be gammas, you say. Something like, we're not too stupid, or we're not too bright. Being a gamma is just right. That's a paraphrase of the jingle of the gammas in Brave New World. We're not too stupid, we're not too bright, but being a gamma is just right. Something close to that. And so the avalanche of gamma formation is ending the intellectual ferment of the last several centuries, perhaps. Anyway, in Berlin, 1910, flatly he denied the historicity of Jesus, thus drawing worldwide attention, and there's even a New York Times report. So, interestingly, and so he said that there's a whole bunch of scholars who supported intentionally or unintentionally denial of the historicity of Jesus of Nazareth. This has been going on basically for the last nearly 300 years. And this is all in relation to Buddhism. The challenging to the historicity of Jesus and the originality and novelty, meaning it's new, the originality, novelty, authenticity of the gospel teachings has been under attack basically for the last 300 years, more or less, starting significantly in the second half of the 18th century. From the angles of those who bring in parallels to Buddhism and I think even Hinduism, and then bringing in references to Apollonius and Vita Apolloni. So the Orthodox defenders of their faith are busy, or had been busy. Now things are quite different. So you had these people in Holland, and you had even Russians, scholars, German, French, Italian, in America in the 19th century mainly, or 20th century. All sorts of people questioning. That's interesting. And his final point is what he calls stage three, which I'm not going to get into too much. This a little bit strained position that the euangelion, or euangelos, or evangelical, or evangelos, the good news of the New Testament, is really the, quote, good news of Buddhism, meaning su-uktam, or suptam, or shuktam. I put some etymologies for people, if you're interested. And so this is not such a critical point, I think, but it's yet another hack at the edifice of, the originality of, the originality, authenticity, novelty of gospel teaching, as well as the historicity of Jesus. It's yet another attack, plank of attack, or angle of attack, it seems. And he's basically saying the seventh paradigm shift that he proposed in his book, another book called Mysticism, subsumes the fact established by Christian Lindner, so this scholars on scholars, he's subsuming, or he's including something that he believes is a fact established by another scholar, that the author of the four Gospels, which tradition has named Mark, Matthew, Luke, and John, were not at all the saintly Middle East personas commonly imagined. They really were Buddhist missionaries from India. Boom! So, this is called pulling the tiger's tail and pulling on the mustache of the hoary gris eminences of the Orthodox Christian Catholic traditions. You can't give them more trouble than that, I think, than saying that Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John were Buddhist missionaries from India. Okay. Could be. I don't know. No proof on any side, you say. Everything's disputable. And that's just where it's at. Humanity can't, you know, a dishonest race doesn't have much access to truth. Use it or lose it. Use discernment and goodwill, honesty, goodwill, sincerity, seeking truth, and you'll find it. Don't commit to that, you won't find it. Don't commit to goodwill, honesty, you won't have discernment, and you won't find truth. So I'll just read a little, and that'll, and then maybe pick this up next week, but this is nearly the end of the discussion of Lockwood's presentation. Probably have to get in a little next week. He said, "My seventh paradigm shift proposed that these evangelists were actually Buddhist missionaries, brilliant literary scholars who had both studied in Alexandria and were then propagating the good news or suktam of the Dharma, and in transmogrified form the Gospels throughout Egypt and beyond." And he rightly, you know, holds a mirror to himself and says, "How do I have the gall to make such outlandish claims?" Good. So he's a reasonable fellow. He goes on, "To understand the basis of such astonishing claims," meaning outlandish or galling, "one must have, I fear, a basic understanding of the Buddhist languages of Pali and Sanskrit, together with willingness to entertain shocking theories." Lintner, Christian Lintner, another scholar, academic, has written several books and dozens of essays identifying hundreds of striking mimetic relations, like mime, mimetic relations, which exist between narrative passages in the Gospels and narrative passages in Buddhist scriptures. But without the Buddhist linguistic foundation, one may not be able to overcome the enthralling power of one's own cultural assumptions or paycheck. But that's nothing to us, enthralling power of cultural assumptions. The real problem here is that you can't check what Lintner's saying and what Lockwood's saying, Lintner's saying, and what these claims are about without knowing Pali and Sanskrit. Because you have to look into the Pali text and the Sanskrit translations of the Pali text, Pali canons, and the Gospels. You'd have to look at Aramaic and Greek, the original texts, oldest texts of the Gospels, in their original language, Aramaic and Greek, I guess, whatever, they're Syriac, I'm not sure. And then, as well, Pali and Sanskrit suttas, to see what he's calling these striking mimetic relations and hundreds of relations between passages in the Gospels and passages in Buddhist scripture. And that just goes on and on and on, and I can't get into this because it's unbelievably complicated. I think I'm going to end today's talk here. There is in section 7, starting on page 65 here, it's called Out of Egypt. And he basically makes the point, and I'm not going to go into it beyond just stating the first paragraph sentence. Essenism, Jessenism, Jessianism, Yesu, Yeshua, Essenism, Jessianism, Yeshuism, Jessenism, I don't know. Whatever, the Essenes, or Essenism, is that, quote, and this is his position, is that, quote, branch of Buddhism, which in the mid-3rd century BCE, so he's talking about that Essenes started several hundred years before the birth of Jesus of Nazareth in the Gospels. Okay. Essenism, here he's saying, is a branch of Buddhism which in the mid-3rd century BC was engrafted onto the Jewish stem of Jesse. And so his Jessianism is Essenism. Stem of Jesse, forming crypto-Buddhism by Indian missionary monks as they surreptitiously moved westward around the Mediterranean lands with the support of King Ashoka. Boy, oh boy. So you can see how the Christian scholars would basically say, get out of here, you fool. you heretic, you know, you silly man, get away. Because they can't investigate anything that he's saying at all, because they don't have the background in Indian, you know, Buddhist history and Pali scripture and Sanskrit translation of Pali scripture, the history of Buddhist missionary activity and King Ashok. So they have no idea, zero. And even the books on Buddhism, they're reading from other people's translations who don't, or are not scholars. So Buddhist scholars are not interested in this, and Christian scholars are not interested in the Buddhist. Okay, so that's the way you go. So it kind of comes to a full stop there, that the Christian scholars reject the Buddhist Lockwood, who's sort of trying to integrate, and the Buddhist scholars in general feel, you know, I'm doing fine, I don't need your help, to the Christian. We've got what we need, and the Christian says, well, we got what we need, and Lockwood's saying, well, you ought to be looking in, because the older tradition of Buddhism is the source of your Gospels, and the defenders of the faith say, you know, thanks, but no thanks, we're okay. Or you're a fool, or worse. And so that's where it ends. Next time, I think I will, just to blow your mind, this is the read this page, 65, which is a page from his book, his other book called Mythicism, in his earlier book, page 26, 27, is quoted here on page 65. The section's called Out of Egypt. He's talking about Essenes, as I said, and then three theorems of limbs of crypto-Buddhism in Alexandria and Qumran. So, clearly, he's free to speculate, and he speculates freely. But it is very interesting, and it just shows you... It kind of is lots of good food for thought. But that's it for today. Next time, we'll pick up next week and start on this page 65 here and read his theorems about how it was that Buddhist missionaries or monks made their way through the Middle East, Egypt, and then the, you know, the Holy Land zone. Had much to do with the formation of the Essene traditions. Very interesting. So, that's it for today. I hope you find it interesting. I think it is. Take good care of yourselves. See you next time, and good night.